Samantha Green works for Applied Survey Research, a nonprofit social research organization based in California. Her primary areas of research include poverty, homelessness, and local concepts of health and human wellness. She has a master's degree in social anthropology from the London School of Economics and a bachelor's degree in anthropology from the University of California, Los Angeles.
I'll probably restructure a bit as we go on, just because we've talked so much kind of about pit counts. But so this is primarily our research is based on pit counts. This year we conducted pit counts in 9 counties. We've been doing them for about 12 years with ASR. So this is really our approach to incorporating homeless youth into our pit count and using a peer-based approach to collecting data. I can figure out how this works. There we go. I have no relationships to disclose. So just very quickly, I'll go over the background of kind of our study, the background of ASR and what we've been doing, an overview of the methods that we use in both our adult counts and then our youth counts, the results from the study just very quickly, and then the limitations and the lessons learned. So I'll just skip through that. But because the points are conducted every 2 years, we've been conducting them since 1999. And we did our first count in Monterey County in 99 using this peer-based approach. We did a general census count at that point. In 2005, due to our kind of understanding that youth were not being counted in these general counts, we began doing a separate count of homeless children and youth, and that was first done in Los Angeles County. In 2009, we expanded those counts, and in 2011, we not only expanded our counts to multiple counties, but we started, we piloted a youth-specific survey, and I'll kind of go through, we have a two kind of pronged approach to data collection. So our overall assumption is that peers are more capable of locating, recognizing, and recruiting their peers. And so by using the peers through this process of data collection, we feel that the results are more valid, they're more acceptable from the community, and that our numbers are much better at participation. It's really all about outreach recruitment, and really we found that the financial incentives provide much better data, it provides a better relationship with the folks that you're working with, and it really is an acknowledgement of their time and their expertise. Let's see, so kind of refining our approach here. Well, the effort takes a lot more time and effort than kind of a volunteer-based outreach effort in census counts. We feel that it really does kind of provide us with a lot more information, much better numbers. Our outreach for our workers in the adult community is really through service providers who do a referral process. We set quotas for each of those service providers that provide us with peers to work with. And that outreach strategy has worked very well with the adults, but when the numbers come back for youth, they're just small. So when we started doing the separate outreach efforts for our youth, we really had to kind of define the age that we were going to be working with, as well as the age that we were going to be outreaching to. Our goal was to really connect with youth that were 16 to 25 as the peer workers, with a focus on connecting with youth under the age of 25. So HUD kind of creates the standard of unaccompanied youth under the age of 18, but a lot of our service providers were providing to under 25. So we collected data on under 25 with the date of birth so we could do breakouts. So again, we really felt that the assumption is much stronger with our youth, and we really felt that it was a great assumption to kind of move forward with. Our youth are way better at recognizing other homeless youth. We go out with other providers and with other researchers, and you'd walk by these youth, whereas the kids that we've been working with are incredible, and they know one another, or they at least know a type and can recognize them. Let's move forward here. So the initial recruitment that we used for our youth was to kind of go through both formal and informal service networks. In areas like Santa Clara County, San Jose, there's large kind of service networks. The Bill Wilson Center there is huge and kind of at the forefront of youth services. They're really well connected. They have a great connection to the community. But we worked in other areas where those services just don't exist. Santa Cruz County, where we're based, doesn't have any youth services. People are kind of disconnected from the community, particularly at that formal service kind of base. So what we did at that point was to really go out in the community, connect in multiple geographies, connect with multiple people that were kind of doing rogue outreach, for lack of a better description. But folks that were, you know, serving burritos on the corners on Tuesday afternoons, that service providers knew about but really didn't have a connection to. It was a lot of walking and talking, but you start to get connected with people who are connected to the community. From there, we kind of allowed the youth to recruit other youth. This allowed us to kind of lengthen the referral chains for the people that we were working with, reducing bias and kind of getting them more spread out in the community. And really, your outreach is dependent kind of on the recruitment of the youth that you initially start with. So for our training process, we conducted the training times in locations that were convenient to them, went to where they were. With our adults, what we primarily do is, you know, we do a training 2 or 3 days before we conduct our census work. We do a training 2 or 3 days before we conduct our survey work. And with our youth, we discovered that it was really hard to get in touch with them. And so the best idea was to do the training and the outreach at the exact same time. So, and they were fantastic. You know, everyone participated. They were really engaged, really involved. They were interested in participating. But tracking them down is a little hard. So the training process kind of went through just the project purpose and the background and why we kind of were doing this, what was important. We went through the protocols and the payment. Like I said before, we really do believe in paying the youth that we were working with. They were paid hourly for their work on the census, and then per survey for their work on the surveys. We conduct them separately just because we found that we get much better respondent rates on our surveys. The census we can move through much faster, and it allows us to do a really lengthy survey. So our basic survey is about 29 questions, and then with our extended youth questions, we went to about 45. So it's a pretty long survey. We went through the data collection process, our census forms, and our survey instrument. The big discussion in our... Is that me or this? Don't know. Was safety and courtesy protocols. So because we were working with youth, we wanted to make sure that they really had safety in mind the whole time. And this is very different when we were working with our adults than it was working with our youth. And we worked with some really great service providers, particularly up in Sonoma, who had a really great understanding of the different communities that they had access to, the different communities that each kid did not have access to, and making sure that they weren't doing outreach in areas that wasn't appropriate for them. And the kids were really open about areas that they could go to and could not. We also talked about the survey implementation and the IRB requirements. Because we were dealing with youth under the age of 18, we did go through an IRB process, and so making sure that they were kind of going through those requirements and really, well, I'll go through kind of everything that was included. So like I said before, our efforts are separate. We do a separate census and a separate survey. Our youth census, we have a youth census form. It's very different from our adult census. In our adult census, we mobilize volunteers, we mobilize peer workers who go out in groups. They cover every single census tract, and we enumerate from 5 a.m. until 8 a.m., so early morning. For our youth census efforts, we kind of do it completely differently. We get together with the youth during that training time to discuss areas where youth normally go. Prior to that, we work with other youth to determine kind of what time would work best. In most communities, this is in the after-school hours, so 2 to 5, when kids are kind of out on the street and more visible and safe. So the youth record the location of the nearest building for where they're finding folks, and then that's later assigned to census tracts for data analysis, and then integrated into our overall results. So here's just kind of some of the results of our street census. So you can see in Santa Clara County, overall under 25, we had 697 kids that were counted. We found that our youth population numbers were increasing from previous years. Santa Clara has done a youth count for multiple years now. In Santa Cruz County, we were really excited. This is the first time that we had done a youth count. And just in our under 18, in 2009, we had 11 kids that were included. So to go from 11 to 88 was, we really felt it was a result of outreach more than kind of a new existence of the population. So our survey process, the kids conducted the surveys in locations that they felt were safe. We, of course, used the same definition of homelessness that everyone else does. Survey respondents were given an incentive for participating, and the youth were paid per survey. And then we do our survey quotas based on geography, making sure that our youth aren't, you know, doing too many surveys in one group, so we limit them to 10 per surveyor. So for our IRB requirements, I know that this would be different for everyone that conducts data with youth, but we were required to do an informed consent of all participants under 18. We included information as part of that informed consent on where they could reach local hotlines, service providers that could help in case any topics were brought up through the questions that they needed support. We provided a self-administered option for those under 18 where they could conduct the surveys themselves rather than doing it as a face-to-face survey, and then they just put it aside sealed envelopes. We found that this actually was used a lot. So a lot of the kids used the sealed envelopes and did the self-administered option. So it was really great. So just really quickly, data highlights. 60% of our youth, this is actually all counties combined. We actually used the same questions for all of our youth pilot survey this year. And so for 60% of our youth reported it was the first time they'd been homeless. 30% reported they had experienced homelessness prior to age 16. 29% were living in a public shelter, 27% outside, 8% in vehicles. This 8% in vehicles was similar to those that were in vehicles in our general population, but it kind of points to the idea that we need to do better outreach in connecting with the peers that we're using as workers, just because the kids that are in the vehicles didn't know the kids that were in the shelters, that didn't know the kids. So really, the more outreach you do through multiple strategies, the kind of the better representation you have. The biggest thing was that, you know, 1 out of 5 youth reported they didn't feel safe in their current living situation. In terms of their health care, 23% reported that since becoming homeless, they had gone without needed health care. 36% were in fair health. 37% reported a mental illness, and a third didn't see themselves getting off the streets. So, kind of sobering data, I apologize. But the great thing was that it kind of pointed to the kind of information that we could get from this. Again, we had, you know, a huge number of indicators on our survey with our 1,012 questions, that's what happens. But there are some big limitations to this approach, which is, you can only generalize, you know, it really isn't generalizable to the basic population because we are working with a small group of youth, and we don't really have an understanding of the full population. It relies heavily on our local networks of service providers, so if you don't have local service providers, it's much more difficult and really does rely on a dedicated staff who's willing to kind of put in that work. All of our data is self-reported, which we know is acceptable for kind of homeless services, but still it provides a limitation. And then the biggest thing is time and money. Because we were paying each of our youth for, you know, $10 an hour and then the money for the surveys, it was a huge cost to each of our continuums that goes beyond the general census. Lessons learned. Let's see. We really found that having the youth involved in not only the survey process, but the outreach process was huge and largely underestimated by all the communities that we worked with. They really shaped a lot of what we did, and we would have them more involved in the future. The recruitment of interviewers is really key to that diverse sample, and the challenge of getting a representative sample just with the youth that we did work with was difficult. Getting kind of a continually building and maintaining the relationships with your service providers, with the youth in your community, is essential. Again, the building flexibility into the recruitment and data collection is kind of, you know, who really needs to say it, but it's true. And then the incentives was really a necessary evil. So one of the things that it's necessary just for us to kind of engage with the population, and then out of respect but it's one of those things that most of our communities, they just don't have the money for the incentives, both for the purchase that's gonna, you know, the gift that's given as an incentive for the survey, as well as paying for the youth. So in the end, we actually, because we worked with 9 communities this year, it was only 6 that actually finished the youth studies. In large part, it was based upon budgetary restraints. And that's pretty much me. Although I was just going to say the one thing that we realized as we were sitting up here talking is that one of the major issues with this study is that we didn't have a lot of qualitative research. So really, that's something that we'd like to kind of add into our research methods, as well as hoping that the rest of you will too.
And I'd like to invite all the speakers up to sit at the head table if you like, although it looks like she's running away at the same time. You're going to come up and join us, is that good? We have about 10 minutes for questions if anybody has any. If you don't, I'm going to start asking questions. That's usually how it goes. Go ahead. And actually, I should have stipulated if you're asked a question directly, if you could come up and answer over here. APHA appreciates documenting all the Q&A sessions at the end. The question was, what theoretical constructs go into designing the surveys that are used?
Because our work was largely done with the point in time counts in mind, a lot of our questions were based on the requirements of the point in time counts. So getting at subpopulation data, chronic illness, mental health, time on the street, duration of homelessness, occurrence of homelessness. And then each of our communities that we work with, they kind of create the theoretical framework that we create questions for, and then those are all field tested. For our youth survey, we actually used kind of the basis was the CHICS survey that's used in the high schools. So kind of asking same questions, similar questions to that, and then history of homelessness. And that's kind of where we started from. With each of our communities, everyone had input, so our surveys kind of changed depending on that.
We stuck a few questions in there.
Things that I was interested in myself, and then some of the communities, we always give the opportunity for them to review the surveys. So with our youth survey, they were all the same for each county, but each county had a little say in a couple of the questions.
Regarding the 2,000 plus variables, that's a rich data set.
Yes, it is. Because as soon as you start asking about number of friends and what you do with different friends, or number of relatives, have you tried to rebuild relationships with parents, mother, father, son, brother, sister, and so on, you end up with lots of variables. I mean, I have to say that, of course, quite a number of these variables, you're down to a small minority of the cases have tried to rebuild relationships with more than 2 relatives, for example. But to ask your answer, to say something about your former formidable general question, we did start out with an attempt to put together a theory of the factors that will influence the outcomes of resettlement. our previous studies, I suppose, have been more about the causes of homelessness at different ages, and there's plenty of literature on that, and the combination of background circumstances and trigger events or whatever. But this was more a study of outcomes, and we're actually struggling right now trying to sort out our ideas on this post-study. It's very interesting. If you take what might seem to be a fairly manifest outcome, tenancy sustainment, have someone stayed in the property, even that isn't straightforward, because you find quite a lot of people who move on for positive reasons, who find better value property, or who build a new relationship. So particularly out of London, where the housing market isn't so stressed and tight, we've got a fair percentage, I think 15%, who've moved on to a second tenancy, even over 18 months. Now, it's not unusual for young people to be very mobile residentially, of course, but it's interesting to see. So that's just, tenancy sustainment is a complex thing. Clearly, we can contrast people who've remained in a tenancy with those who've evicted or been abandoned. The other outcomes we're struggling with, just to be very brief, are housing satisfaction. We had to devise our own questions that tried to give us scores on that, and we can produce a satisfaction index, which changes interestingly over time. But the third thing that Maureen insisted on was that we had settledness as something different from housing satisfaction. And that is what we're working on now. One final comment, I can't resist saying. Many people would think that affordability of a property is a very important influence on housing satisfaction and settledness. But actually, in a very low-income population, receiving housing subsidies in the UK, up until the current government, at least, affordability was hardly an issue, because whatever your rent, it was subsidised by the government. The present government is trying to get rid of that. But it becomes complicated, of course.
Any other questions?
I have a question for the homeless system. So I'm Jill Wolfer. I'm from the Information School at the University of Washington. I too am not a public health professional. I'm an information scientist. So I was, I've done some work with, you know, place and homelessness. I work with homeless young people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was thinking of as you were going through your pictures is the work of James Spradley. There's a book mm-hmm. called You Owe Yourself a Drunk. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, Spradley utilized this triadic analysis to describe sleeping places. And I don't know what steps you might take with your work as you move forward, but mm-hmm. are you looking at these constructions of where people sleep as a way that homeless people define themselves, sort mm-hmm. of in the nature of the way that Spradley was, mm-hmm. or are you looking at them as evidence that you could use for architectural purposes? It sounds like your goal is to build.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering about the nature of those.
Right. Things. Actually, our next step would be, we're interested in two things. One is the use of urban space, because that's contested terrain. The government says, no, you homeless people can't be here. Mm-hmm. Private entities, households don't want them. But at the same time, you know, when you talk about a public space is for all people. So it's just that issue of, what exactly, what are our boundaries? That's one. The second is more practical. Okay, so we know they sleep in certain places because they like the privacy, they like the enclosure, spatial enclosure, they like, of course, heat. What's our responsibility as architects to design affordable houses, or even not even houses, but units that reuse materials that have been discarded by other buildings that are deconstructed, part of that sustainability change. So we're more of, okay, what now? And building. Building is one big thing we're interested in.
Right. Do you see any, what are the possible repercussions of that? I mean, could something bad happen out of that kind of intervention?
Yes. We've been thinking about that. That's why we're treading very slowly. We don't want necessarily to have an island of container vans. It's going to devalue property around it, next to it, near to it. We don't know. I know that there's a concept that's brewing where instead of putting them all together in one space, not necessarily container vans, but makeshift units, to spread them out, scatter them. But again, the issue there is, okay, if you scatter them, they need to be close to services. So how are they going to go from one place to another? So it's really a very complex, you know, situation, and we're still looking at it. Yeah.
Well, and on that note, we managed to form a perfect circle back to the first panel we had where we talked about scattered site housing at the end of that. So, anyway, that's all the time we have. Obviously, if you guys are willing to stick around, I'm sure everybody would love to talk. Thank you so much for coming. And let's give them all one last round of applause. These are great studies. I'm going to